My co-host today is Sherry Siegel, neurologist. We've been doing some very interesting programs. Hey, you know, be careful out there in the rain, but I've been watching the most amazing thing, Sherry. You know, I've been looking out. We have right here outside our office two baby pigeons who are sitting out there on the shelf. And up where I live, right outside my window, are two mourning doves who are sitting on two eggs. And these things are, the deluge is coming. You know, they've had more rain than you could imagine. You think about us humans running around and darting indoors because rain's going to hit us. These birds have just sat out there and been pounded by the rain. It hasn't changed a thing. Those eggs, in one case, the eggs are still there. They're getting sat on. In the other case, the eggs hatched. And we got these baby birds. Nature sure is funny.
Nature in the Big Apple.
I had a friend of mine came in from Germany once, and he laughed. He said, "You Americans." He said, "Only you Americans put the weather in the newspaper." He said, "It's only weather. It's only weather." But, you know, we get afraid of a lot of things. We fear many things, and whatever makes headlines tends to bring up some anxiety on our part. And fear is just becomes you. I really believe that having enough hormones in the water and enough anxiety-causing stimulation all around us, that we're kind of programmed for fear. We're kind of programmed to be a little more frightened. And then there are things that go wrong that you can't even see or you can't even recognize. And I was thinking about you, Sherry. I was thinking about you as a neurologist. What are some of the neurological things that people live with that they think, you know, oh, what's wrong? I have a tick. Well, my fingers are numb, you know. Things that people live with that they don't even know are neurological and maybe neurological damage. Now, on the other side of that, I want to make a statement that I think you probably could live with an awful lot and not have to pay attention to it. But the nervous system is so interesting. Because we can't see it. You can't really feel your nervous system. You could say, "I'm nervous." You know, but you can't really feel your nervous system. Can you feel yourself think? Can you feel the blood going down your back? Can you feel that? Can you really feel the nerves and the arteries? That's part of it. That the design of nature was, don't pay attention. It's going to happen automatically. Do you agree?
I agree completely. I think that's the beauty of the brain. It works without us thinking about it. So we're able to move without thinking about it, breathe without thinking about it. We see automatically, hear automatically. Sometimes we focus our attention, but even when we're not focusing our attention, the body works and the brain works on its own.
Pretty amazing how you could ignore it, abuse it, beat it up a little bit, you know? Kick it around and the body survives. Now, unfortunately, that we're tending to live longer, you see some of the consequences of your behaviors. But the body takes a good beating. It really does. Let's talk about some of the things that people might observe in other people that people might not even be aware are some part of the nervous system breaking down. Right. Just for example, like you and I were talking about someone when they walk with an unusual gait, and the unusual gait is specifically when their legs are far apart and they're walking like they're carrying something on these two legs. What is that called?
Right. That's called a wide-based gait. That means instead of walking as we normally do with our legs underneath us, the legs are out far, and that way a person maintains their balance. When their balance is affected, either because they can't feel the floor beneath them and their feet are not telling their brain what's going on the floor, or their brain is not functioning normally and their sense of balance is off.
Oh, that's interesting. When I sit sometimes in an unusual position, my legs fall asleep, or one of my legs fall asleep. And it's always fun to get up on that leg, right? Because how am I going to put this on the ground when I have no control over it?
Exactly.
Whatsoever. Exactly. So I do it for balance. I do it, well, what would be the thing that would hold me in place? Okay. Dizzying. Dizzy is all a neurological phenomenon?
Well, it can be
non-phenomenon, sorry.
It could be heart. The heart could cause it. Irregular heartbeats can cause you to feel lightheaded, or your blood vessels can shunt the blood away from the brain and to the arms and legs. And when the brain doesn't get enough blood circulation, sometimes people pass out. So they may call that dizzy. Neurologists like to call that lightheadedness. We have another name.
Lightheadedness is different than dizzy, according to neurologists, right?
Dizzy breaks down into two possibilities. One is lightheadedness, and then that could come from the blood vessels not behaving well and not giving blood to the brain, or the heart not pumping well because of irregular heartbeats. That can cause the brain to become lightheaded and sometimes even pass out. On the other hand, the other part of dizziness is something called vertigo. Vertigo is a sense of movement, or people often think of it as spinning, when the world spins around and they feel like someone's just spun them around on a merry-go-round.
Well, when you have vertigo, what could be the causes of vertigo?
There are a bunch of different causes. One of the common ones is called benign positional vertigo. And that's what happens then is a rock, and it's going to sound a little strange, but there's actually a little rock that becomes displaced in what's called your semicircular canals. They have fluid in the inner ear.
Now, wait a minute. Back this up, because I've seen enough diagrams of this over my time and models of it. In our little semicircle canal, this beautiful thing, this organ we have called the ear, which is kind of remarkable how it works with the tympanic membrane and the vibrations it picks up, turning them into sound, and, you know, that turns into eventually music, and we get Beethoven from his ear. I mean, it's just remarkable. One of my engineers is an engineer I have who has worked for me. He's one of the leading radio engineers in the world. He's deaf. He has another way of doing it, a remarkable way. He's very efficient. But let's see, just to go back now. Now, if you have this inner ear disturbance, now in the inner ear, there's a stone, a rock. What is this thing? It must be an organ of some kind.
You're right. The semicircular canal, it looks like a little snail with three different loops. Each of those loops has fluid in it. It's called endolymph. And inside there as well are what's called hair cells. Hair cells sometimes get an accumulation of calcium, which is like a little rock. And when one of those little rocks becomes displaced, the fluid gets pushed around. The rock moves around, and the fluid gets pushed around. And the brain thinks the world is moving when it's not really moving at all. And so people get a terrible sense of the world spinning. They sometimes get nauseated. Their balance is affected because the world feels like it's spinning. And it usually gets better within minutes. Sometimes there's another disorder called Meniere's disease, where people have this vertigo, episodes of vertigo, hearing problems, and tinnitus. That's when there's ringing or weird sounds in the ears.
Hmm. Those are real things.
Yes, they are.
That take place. And when you get these, you could say, well, there's damage to your nerves, or there's something affecting your nerves. And we could treat it somehow. Sometimes we may operate on you. Sometimes we may immobilize you and hope it heals itself. Other times we give you medication, right? What are the general treatments for what seems to be nerve damage?
Well, if it's a problem of the inner ear, something like the vertigo from benign positional vertigo, sometimes just movements of the head, special movements that sometimes physical therapists can do or ear doctors can do, where they help move the rock back into a place where it doesn't cause trouble.
I like that. It's like, you know, when you see the movie where the guy's got a dislocated shoulder and his buddy comes along and kicks it into place.
Yes.
Right,
yes.
There. You fixed it.
Oh, that hurts like heck. But the good news is this doesn't hurt, but the dizziness does. It's a little bit hard. There are exercises you can do for it, too.
In neurology, in that world, you must run into the people that I run into, which are the people who imagine that there's something wrong with them. There are people who go through life believing that there is some kind of condition or disease that they have, that they have to discover, that's been undiscovered. And I'm going to use the word hypochondriacal. Hypochondriasis, meaning that it's like more worried than it should be over something, and it may be something imaginary, you know? it may be an imaginary disorder. You're worried about something. We're going to talk about hypochondriasis because it affects many more people than you think. I often wonder if the people who are so set on balancing their chemistry in a nutritional way may not be coming from that place. Do you know what I mean? You've got to take enough vitamin B, and you got to take enough vitamin C, and you got to take this, and you take 47 pills a day, then you take testosterone and estrogen and antidepressants, and you're going to just try to balance it out. You're going to get control over your chemistry because you're going to beat it. That's one. And I can't leave it alone, because if I leave it alone, what's going to happen? I'm going to become old. What's going to happen? But they function almost out of fear. Let's talk about hypochondriasis. What are the signs of hypochondriasis? What are the definition?
Well, one of them is excessive fear or anxiety about having a particular disease or condition.
And another one is worry that the minor symptoms mean you have a serious illness. You know, I used to love, what was it called? The Hawthorne effect. No, it wasn't the Hawthorne effect. It was another thing. The Hawthorne effect was when you're studying something, the effect that you have on the thing you're studying has to be calibrated into whatever you're doing. But it was another effect. It was student's disease, I think it was called.
Medical student's disease.
Medical student's disease.
Because what happens every time you study a different disease in the body, you start thinking, I have that symptom. Oh, and I have that symptom too. Maybe I have this disease. So just the awareness of these different symptoms makes you reflect on your own body. And it's normal to have symptoms. It's blowing these symptoms, taking them to a very large degree and really having them cause the fear that makes you think that you have a life-threatening illness.
Well, anything that we do that may be benign can also be toxic in its own way.
You're right. It's hard to know. Is a cough just a cough? Or is a cough something much more severe? So people who have hypochondriasis are plagued with trying to make that decision and not knowing.
With hypochondria, you believe that normal bodily sensations or vague symptoms mean that you have an underlying disease. You may believe that your body's occasional twinges mean you have cancer, or forgetting where you placed your keys means you have Alzheimer's. You become so convinced that you seek doctor after doctor in search of a diagnosis. Now, this is a very, very interesting thing. So these people go for repeated medical exams or consultations. And I see it, every now and then when I go, if I go to a physician, I see a dozen or so people in the waiting room, usually elderly people. I would bet a good number of them are there because they're worried about a disease more than they have a disease. Do you see a lot of that in neurology? Do you have the kind of imagined disorders?
Yes, there are. There are people who worry terribly about what's going on in their body. They feel something, and they develop what's called a hypervigilance. It means they're very aware, always looking, always checking. Is my arm okay? Is my leg okay? Is my back all right? What is that tingling feeling? What is that? What could that be? And so that constant concern and focus on different symptoms in the body really make their life a terror.
What are the other symptoms that people have?
Well, strained social relationships is another symptom, because people who suffer from this are always attending to things in their own body, their own symptoms. And sometimes their family members are worried about them. Sometimes they question whether or not these illnesses are real. So it makes for very strained relationships.
It does. And, there's a problem. If you're a caretaker, sometimes you like to believe that the person has an illness. And in a way, you support the illness by being a caretaker. In other words, if you're taking care of that person, I'll never forget the stuff in the Mayo Clinic, what they do and how they treat most pain is to minimize it completely. And they really believe that it's up to the job of both the partner and the person to minimize their pain reactions, because they believe that you could build it out of proportion, making it worse than it is. So one is One is that the relationships become based on a caretaker, sick person kind of relationship, which, let me warn you, is dangerous, because when the sick person finally gets better, the relationship doesn't have a leg to stand on. It's a very difficult thing. So one is that you get, and you get a lot of goodies out of being sick. So part of it is you have a relationship with somebody who's worried about you and is staying attached to you. They won't leave you because you're sick. As soon as they find out you're better, they may leave. So you're fostering this. You're kind of keeping it going. So there's secondary gain out of having this. But meanwhile, let's say you do believe that you have these illnesses. You do doctor shopping. And doctor shopping is this thing that you do. And I'm sure that's what Michael Jackson did. You know, he was doctor shopping. Because the way you go from doctor to doctor, and I've treated movie stars, I'm sure you have too, they go to you only as long as you tell them what they want to hear. They have such a world of yes people around them that they don't care. They don't want to hear anything they don't want to hear. So if you say to them, no, you shouldn't take this, you should bear with the pain, they say, give me the next doctor. Why should I just go through pain? Give me the next one. He'll give me the pills. Or if they say, you know, if a doctor advises you correctly, very often you'll leave that doctor and search another one. If you go to a doctor and the doctor says to you, will you stop worrying about your health? Will you stop it? Will you stop being so obsessed about your well-being? You know, stop. You're okay. You're doing more damage to yourself with your worry than you are by the things you're doing.
Right. One of the symptoms is an inability to be reassured by medical exams and by doctors. But it's not really ever appropriate for a doctor to minimize someone's fear. They may not have an illness, but hopefully people can find doctors who don't minimize the fear about it, because the fear is as damaging as any disease might be. Because sometimes that fear drives them into constant obsession or compulsion to have tests. Obsession about having a disease, compulsion to have tests and go to doctors. So it can, the fear itself and the psychosomatic disorder can be as much of an illness as another life-threatening illness, such as cancer.
Mm. What are the symptoms of hypochondriasis?
Some people frequently check their body for symptoms or lumps or sores, or they might look at a sore.
Boy, you know, breast cancer fear is enormous.
Yes.
And it's encouraged. You check yourself 45 times, you know, check yourself. How much do you think people really have to check themselves? Because they're keeping it in their mind. Do I have a lump? Do I have a lump? Do I have a lump? Is it, I mean, tell me, as a doctor, you really got to ask that question to yourself every morning when you get up and you look in the mirror and you start examining yourself for lumps?
Well, you have to get to know your own lumps. I mean, unfortunately, breasts are not usually without lumps. We have lumps. And so if you get to know your regular lumps, you'll know when something's abnormal. So it really is a good idea to do that exam, to get to know yourself and to do it on a regular basis. I'm not a gynecologist, but I think it's recommended that you do it once a month.
Once a month. Now, what if you're doing that every day?
Every day, multiple times a day. Some people,
or every day.
Some people are obsessed with trying to find lumps or being concerned that there are lumps, and that can take over someone's life.
Frequent checking of vital signs such as your blood pulse or blood pressure. People do that a lot. The inability to be insured. Now, this is an interesting thing to have a medical exam and get medical findings and not to believe that they found what's wrong with you. Avoidance of situations that make you feel anxious. Now, what is that about?
Well, sometimes just being in a hospital or going to a doctor's office can cause people's blood pressure to go up. They call it the white coat syndrome. Sometimes children who go to doctors are so fearful of doctors, because I guess they associate it with getting a shot, that their heart rate goes up and they're very fearful, and that may be taken into adulthood.
So hypochondriasis, my friends, it's a real question you have to ask yourself, because on a part of it, you know, you want to take care of yourself in many ways, and if you worry about it too much, it becomes costly. But we live in a society where people look at each other and they say, you know, we got to be physically fit, and fit is important, and nutrition is important, and what you've got to do, almost as if the most important thing about a human is their... I've heard often enough somebody say to somebody else, as long as you have your health. You know, and I think that's, well, you know, wait a minute. I'd like you to have your mind, too. I'd like you to be sane. I wouldn't like you to just have your health. I mean, if you stay in a room and you're in a hospital bed and you're done regularly, moved around so that you could stay alive, that's not the idea. The idea is to preserve your sign.
Right, so your body, you want your body health and your mind health.
But some people see hypochondriasis as a form of obsessive-compulsive disorders. And I don't think there's a way for us to talk about it without talking about the nature of that, you know? The before we go into that, though, there is something I'll say about what I understand about this. Fear of punishment. I believe that the people who become too involved are afraid of being punished. I think one of the ideas or one of the symptoms of hypochondriasis is that you're waiting for punishment to happen. I know people who have done, I know this takes place in certain sexual environments. In certain sexual environments, there are people who want to get AIDS, right? Now, here's the problem. The problem is they want to have a wild sex life. They want to have a free sex life, and they're always afraid of AIDS, and so they have to use contraceptive, and they can't be as random as they want to be sexually. So in the communities where there are a lot of AIDS, they will go and they will actually find an AIDS donor to have sex with so that they could get AIDS, so that they could stop worrying. And there are people who are AIDS donors. Yeah? And right. There are people out there who are looking to get AIDS so that they could stop worrying, so that they could be free.
So the relief that they get when they get the disease...
is now they can have all the sex they want.
Let's go of all the fear that they had, so I see. So in other words, the fear kept them from doing what they wanted to.
Their very idea for having chosen this lifestyle was the random sex that was available. You see, you could walk down the street, you could go to the trucks, you could go down to the subways, you could always meet a mate. See, you could always find somebody who wanted to have sex just as much as you did. That was the idea of choosing this lifestyle. When AIDS came along, everybody was now frightened, and you have to be careful, and they're closing the baths, and they won't let you have this. So the fear of getting AIDS made a whole different lifestyle. You now have this lifestyle that's filled with fear, and some people said, that's enough of that. I'm going to go get AIDS so that I don't have to worry about it. Now, of course, that sounds very, very distorted. You know, it's very distorted thinking, but you have to consider now, why would people be so afraid of getting things? Okay, let's leave AIDS out. People who are very active sexually are afraid of being punished for their sexuality. People who are very people who tend to cheat people, cheat them out of money, cheat them out of things. They're always waiting to get punished. They're always looking around the corner. You know, if you're a petty thief, you think any minute somebody's going to tap you on the shoulder. And I believe that people who are hypochondriacal have as their source, as their root, the belief that they should be punished for being evil. So when I'm treating them psychologically, what I'm doing is looking for the part of them that feels evil, because they're waiting to get punished. Some people are waiting to get punished by God. They have these phobias about Allah and phobias, many fears about God, and their fears that they'll be punished by God, because they were told as kids, God's going to punish you, God's going to punish you, God's going to punish you, Jesus is everywhere, Allah will come down and strike you dead with a, you know, I mean, it's just like all these things in the religion, so they live in fear of that. So part of underneath the hypochondriasis is, I am meant to be struck dead, I am meant to be made ill. And what I find in working with people who are hypochondriacs is underneath it has to do usually with their kind of rebellion against their parents. That somehow they believe, I am going to be punished for having rebelled against my family. I'm going to be punished, so any minute now I'm going to either get the disease, or I'm going to age too fast, or I'm going to lose my sexuality, or whatever it is going to happen. And so there are two kinds of people. There are three kinds of people, actually. There are people who worry all the time. There are people who are always guiding themselves physically to make sure they get everything right, and they're doing all the right things all the time. Then there are people who neglect themselves as well. But underneath it all, I find a need for punishment. And a little later in the show, we're going to ask people to call in with any concepts they have related to this, you know, about their own feeling or fear that there may be some punishment coming their way. It's an interesting thing. This is Armand DeMille with Sherry Siegel. We're talking about this. We're going to talk a little more as we get back from our break about the obsessive compulsive disorder. And we're talking about hypochondriasis right now. What do you do if you have a family member who you know doesn't have an illness, but they're just crazy about this, you know? Sherry, what do you do?
It's as much of a challenge for a family member as it is for the person suffering from hypochondriasis. Sure. Because you're together all the time. Frequently, when you have a medical illness of any sort, your caregivers and your family, your support system, is always affected by how you are. And certainly it can be very difficult. People who are caregivers can become depressed. They can feel overwhelmed and really not know what they can do to help the person.
So what happens is you try to find a way to help the person, but you've got to not buy into it. You have to say at some point, I believe, I love you, I care about you. I believe that your response to this pain is coming from somewhere. But I believe from the evidence that I've seen that there's nothing really wrong with you. And I love you and I'll stick with you. But I can't join you in this search that you have. And I can't have you destroying our whole family by spending money on all these products that are used to kind of stave off the evil demons. Maybe you need a shrink, you know?
So they don't want to enable the person with hypochondriasis.
Yeah, you don't want to enable them because it doesn't get any better at all. It doesn't get better. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break. I do have sweet, sweet music for you today because it's time for that. Tomorrow I'll be doing a program about being single in New York, especially being single in the later years, like 45 and older as opposed to 25 and older, and what that's like in the world. I'd love to hear you guys talk about that. We'll be doing that with your calls as well. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little music, and then we'll continue.
Okay, Armand, we're only doing one break, this one. You come back right after this.
Hello, I'm Nick Nolte. You're listening to WBAI, listener-sponsored community radio in New York City. WBAI needs your support. Please be generous. Thank you.
Okay, stand by, Armand. Stand by. 5, 4, 3, 2. Bring music up. Thank you.
has George Lewis, Jazz from Preservation Hall, my friends. Beautiful stuff. There's a difference between obsessions and compulsions, right? Very clear. Did you know that? Obsessive-compulsive disorder means both. You obsess, which means you think about. You compulse, which means you do. So obsessive-compulsive can be broken into two categories. Obsessiveness is a list of obsessions that people have. They have some common obsessions. Here's the ones that people obsess the most about. Contamination has 33%. A third of the people who obsess are worried about contamination. 16% are worried about aggression. Right? They think about it all the time. Now, the need for exactness, you would think that that would be higher, but it's only 8%. And sexual needs are only like 5% of the stuff. Hoarding, saving money, is 4% of the obsession. Now, this is among people who are deeply obsessed. Now, let's talk about the compulsions. Checking. That means you're not sure if you turn off the stove. You're not sure if you locked your door. You got to go back to it over and over and over again. Some of you have gone through that. Biggest percentage of people, almost a third of the people. Cleaning and washing and getting everything clean. Remember, we have the big fear of contamination. On the other side, we have the behavior of cleaning and washing. Other compulsions that you could have is ordering and arranging, hoarding and collecting, counting. There are some people who love to count. They just count numbers. It's as if they're trying to organize their minds. So obsessions and compulsions, two different things. They have this way of occupying the brain. They have this way of taking over the mind.
Yes, when someone has an obsession, they can't get it out of their mind. They just keeps bouncing back and forth. They turn it over. It always reminds me of when I've had a tooth pulled at the dentist. You know, your tongue always wants to go to that spot.
They say, don't keep your tongue out of that hole. What do you mean, keep my tongue out of that hole?
It's impossible. And the same thing when you have an obsession. Your mind turns it over, looks at it in different directions. You talk about it. You think about it. It keeps you up at night. It begins to take over your life.
And you have to do something about it in some way. But sometimes it just goes away by itself. You know, sometimes this stuff goes away by itself. Our telephone number here is 212-209-2900, my friends. 212-209-2900. Physical health obsession. So we're talking about the hypochondriasis. You know, have you been touched by it? Do you think you may be one of the people? No joking around, but it's a serious thing when it happens to somebody, when you get caught in it. There are some people, you know, there's a thing... There are disorders like Munchausen syndrome. Now, what is the Munchausen syndrome itself?
Munchausen's is when someone has hypochondriasis to the nth degree, a super version of it, where they actually go and have multiple abdominal surgeries. They're so convinced that they're so good at convincing the healthcare practitioner that they have something wrong. The healthcare practitioner, the doctor, the nurse, goes and orders test after test, and they actually can have surgery to correct what the perceived problem is.
So Munchausen, because Munchausen was the man himself was a prevaricator. He was a liar. He made things up. You know, it was like, who was he, a duke or something? Munchausen was known for making things up. And these are people who make things up. In Munchausen syndrome, then there's this thing called Munchausen by proxy, which is another funny thing.
Right.
Which you guys see in your medical rooms all the time.
Munchausen by proxy is a parent who believes a child has an illness. And people with Munchausen's or Munchausen's by proxy really believe that the illness exists and that something is wrong. And when they have these surgeries, they're completely convinced that the surgery is going to help them. and they're crushed when it doesn't. So Munchausen by proxy is when a parent will take a child to doctor after doctor, have test after test. Something is wrong with my child. I know something is wrong. She doesn't look right. She's not eating normally. I can just tell. Please, please do something to help us.
And it gets you, the mother, to, in effect, get treated yourself, because the doctors are paying attention to you through your daughter as well. So some people think of it as a way of garnering attention. You know, you want to get attention, and attention from doctors seem to matter a great deal.
But it's all subconscious. It's not somebody who says, gee, I want attention. I'm going to take my child to the doctor. It's much more subtle and something that they're not even aware of.
So you think that they really believe it?
I'm convinced that they do.
I once sat in an emergency room behind the gate. Now, behind the gate means in the triage room, where people were all coming in for all various reasons. And, in fact, Nurse Jackie had this on the show recently. She said, the majority of people coming in here are coming in here for drugs. And she had this great test. Did you see it, have by chance? She had a great test. She yelled out into the waiting room. She said, okay, how many people here are having trouble raising your right hand? And they all raised their right hand because they were in there really for other reasons. You see so many mixed things that it becomes almost impossible for you, the physician, to tell what's real and what's not real. In my business, the psychotherapy business, we don't run into much of that. People pay money, and they mostly tell the truth. Mostly they're telling us the truth, but they're not trying to get something out of us. You know, for you, it's like you, the doctors, have so much power. Either you give me special attention, or you're going to give me drugs or chemicals. Doctoring has become very different, hasn't it, over the years?
I think it's always been challenging for a doctor to really make the right diagnosis, localize the lesion, and then find out what the cause of the lesion might be. And when it comes to psychiatric and psychological disease, it is much more challenging. Sometimes doctors haven't been trained very much on the psychology of illness. And so it's something that we can learn from you and your colleagues.
Telephone number here is 212-209-2900. My guest, as usual on Wednesdays, is Dr. Sherry Siegel. Let's take one of your calls. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air. Hello there. 212-209-2900. We're taking your calls. 212-209-2900. Hi, you're on the air. It's Armand DeMille.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, doctors, good afternoon. I would like to know if you can help me. I am trying to determine whether I have a friend with my age, I'm 68 years old, who has been diagnosed 15 years ago, actually longer than that, with multiple chemical sensitivities. And I find that it is more than just chemicals that seem to provoke profound reactions, much more acute than anything that would be considered, I hate to use the word normal because I'm never sure what normal is.
Is this a lady friend of yours?
Yes.
Okay, so you have a lady friend who you care about a great deal. And she is very sensitive to many, many things. And you sit there and you just never know. And you see her having these enormous reactions. Does she have the kind of reactions that are like allergic reactions?
Yes. And her eyes swell up, can't breathe. And of course, most of the relationship has been in an ideal situation in that we are separated by about 60, 70 miles, and we conduct most of our relationship via telephone. So we don't have any view of each other, and her environment is usually a controlled one in a hotel room or someplace because she cannot find a place that's suitable because mold, new carpet glue, anything that has any kind of an odor, bleach from cleaning fluids, just absolutely drive her into incapacity.
Well, let's see, Sherry.
This sort of disorder is completely incapacitating for somebody because one never knows where the chemicals might be, and one doesn't really always know what chemicals.
So you're validating it. You're saying, yes, people have this sensitivity. You don't imagine that this could be imagined. You don't think a person could, with their mind, say, oh, I'm so sensitive, and as a way of isolating themselves, the purpose of it is to keep yourself isolated from the world.
I want to make it clear that I completely agree. This could be something that it could be in the body or it could be in the mind. And, of course, those are connected.
Now, in the mind would mean that you would be able to create some kind of a response in your body when you feel threatened by the presence of something that would, in effect, be on the outside world. So let me ask you something. What's your name, by the way?
Mike.
Mike, how come you're not living with her?
Well, first of all, I tried to get her out of the environment. I had her stay in my place overnight, and we couldn't get past 3 hours into what would be the sleep cycle without her reacting to the fumes from the oil burner that I had. I'm in a basement apartment.
Uh-huh.
Having overcome that, we found another situation. I snore like a Kodiak bear, and, of course, there was no containing. It turns out a dog barking, a door closing, to her is a door slamming. She can hear conversations through closed doors, rooms away.
So it sounds like she really wants to be alone, or she prefers to be alone.
Yes, unfortunately, that's essentially cutting her off from the rest of the world.
Okay, so wait, let's change this a little bit here for a minute. Now, you've fallen in love with somebody who is a loner. And I'm willing to bet in many ways you're a loner yourself, are you not?
Well, I'm divorced, but I have a child living in the same building who's now just made me a grandfather.
Uh-huh. How do you like the baby? How do you like the grandchild?
This is just the most amazing experience. See a whole, everything just developing. It's just a reiteration of everything I remember from youth and raising the children without the fuss and muss.
All right, so I take it back. You're not a loner, okay? But you've fallen in love with somebody who's a loner, and here's the deal. Whether or not there's a possibility of a cure or a change, there must be something you get from this love relationship by telephone that feeds you, even as it is. Let's say it's never going to change. Could you live with this the way it is?
You hit it, because I have an engineering background, and I do not accept a no for an answer when it comes to a challenge. Now, I've long left the electronics world, and I find that some of the things I've learned are actually helpful as far as the quality of lives of another human being. And as long as I can make a difference, I want to. And here is a person who I more than ever want to make a difference. And I've been, for the last 3 years, on the phone practically 9 to 12 hours a day on certain days, making calls to places where she can find a green apartment. There's always something wrong with whatever we find, because it's either too expensive or it's too far away, or just always something that doesn't work. And it's gotten so frustrating that I don't know what to do next. And she's run out of money, and we don't know. As of Thursday, she has her last day at the hotel's paid for, and she has no source of income other than a small pension and Social Security. And she is doomed. She's
not doomed. Oh, no, Mike. No.
Only to live in her car. She's been had done that for a couple of days, which was very, very difficult.
Mike, it's very sad, and you've taken under your wing somebody who is truly broken. It's not going to get better.
That's what I use the word, she's the angel with the broken wings.
You know, and so this is what you're caring for now, but I have a feeling that the energy from your grandchild is going to loop into you in such a way that you're going to find yourself a little more distance from this intense negativity. You see, you'll find yourself a little more distant from it. And maybe at some point you say to yourself, I'm sorry to hear it. It's not what I can do. I'm not going to solve this problem. And a funny thing happens when you tell somebody that you're not going to solve the problem for them. Very often, they learn to take care of the problem themselves.
Well, I've gotten basically to that point. I said, look,
I hear.
Pulled everything, every hair out of my head has been tugged upon, and I have yet to find anything that's viable. And right now, I have no mental fertility for any direction to point, say, go that way.
I hear you. We'll just, you know, it's say a prayer and hug your grandchild.
And I'm hoping that you get the care that you need, Mike, because this is taking a great toll on your health, your mental health, your physical health. Sometimes you need the help of a professional, just as your friend might need that help as well.
You know, very often they have in airplanes, when there's a threat, the airplane's going to go down, the first thing they say is put the oxygen mask on yourself before you put it on your child. Take care of yourself.
This is what is. She has her own two children in the forest, and they totally reject her and told her never to come near them again.
Yeah,
and she
I
feels
hear.
So isolated, and I feel so sorry. And I just know there's an answer out there because she goes to a clean room where
I think raised. Mike, I'm going to have to get going, but I think you're going to have to let this one find its own balance. It sounds to me that if she's alienated her own children, she's got to find a way to unalienate them.
At the death sentence, she's got two aneurysms, and she is
I hear you. Totally helpless,
and I don't think she'll be alive this time next year if nothing intervenes.
I hear you, Michael. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks for listening.
Right. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call.
Hi.
Hi there. You're on the air. Hello.
Great work as usual.
Thank you.
This is what I was thinking when you were talking before about...
Well, who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Anna.
Hello, Anna.
How are you?
I'm excellent.
Okay. You're the only guy on radio or television that does this kind of work. The only person. And I think it's wonderful.
Well, there are a lot of other guys on the air who do this kind of thing. You know, they do it, like Dr. Phil. But they just put people down.
No, but it's all advice and common sense. It's not deep.
Yeah.
It's not the psychology of why the person is doing it. Which brings me to, a couple of years ago, I wrote a script. I brought it to a legit agent, and she said, I can sell this, and I never went back. Now, I do this in my life. If I get near some kind of success, I walk away.
Uh-huh.
And my friends tell me, you're afraid of success, but I don't really know what that means.
I don't know what that means either, but, sometimes it's much more comfortable to be in the middle than it is to be at the top. And some part of you may know that, because even though, success means it's such a great idea to have success and to stand out from the crowd, who knows? Maybe you're just saying to yourself, I don't want to stand out from the crowd. I just want to be a regular person.
Well, sometimes I think of that, but I work so hard. I write so hard. I wonder if I had a mother that was like a drama queen and my father was an alcoholic, but my mother, she had to be number one, and I was wondering if I'm...
Punishment, yes.
Hello?
I hear that. The punishment from your mother. That somewhere your mom is somewhere in the back of your head and you're giving her your first spot. You're letting her be in charge.
And why am I doing that? Because I was afraid of her?
Because in some way it's your way of loving your mother.
I see. So
giving her your success, It's all right.
Is there any way I can get out of that?
Yes,
position?
It's happening already. It's happening today by your asking the question. It's happening already.
Okay.
You see? And you're in the process of it, and you're looking at it. Part of the reason you complimented me on the nature of the deep work I do is, in a way, it's a compliment to you, because you do the deep work as well, and you're looking at this in depth. And it may be time to release your mom,
Is there a special way you could do that, like get a punching bag, or...?
You know what I like to do? I do like something. I do like to write on paper, rice paper. And I do like to take something on rice paper and put it in a big ashtray. Remember ashtrays, those things?
Right.
Or any bowl? And I used to light it. And I would like to light it and watch it. And I find those most beautiful. I think the very best way to do it is to get amaretto cookies. And you get the wrappings of amaretto cookies, and you put them in a cylinder in an ashtray, and you light the top of them, and by the time they get down to the bottom, they fly off to the top. Just the wrapping. It's a beautiful thing. I like a fire symbol.
I see. Okay.
All right? It's a ritual.
That I have to live my life, in the past.
Well, yeah, but most of us do, until we're ready to grow up. So what happens later? So what? You got a lot of years to go.
That's true.
Thank you for calling in.
Okay. You are wonderful.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye. 212-209-2900. A quick last call we could get in here. Armand DeMille with Dr. Sherry Siegel. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Donna.
Hello, Donna.
Hi. I was thinking that I'm adopted, and my mother hid her pregnancy until she went in labor in her bedroom. She
was
mom. And I think there was it's my biological mother, and I think there was some talk of maybe she tried to do away with. So I feel like, I always felt like I kind of cheated death, you know,
mm-hmm.
at that age, and I keep waiting to find something wrong with me so that, you know, because
it's going to come and get you one day.
I'm supposed to be here.
See, but that's another thing. That's just like, since I only have a second, let me tell you, that's another way of loving your mother. Another way of staying attached to your mother is to believe that one day you still owe her your life in some way, that she's in control of your life.
Mm.
You'll let her go too. You know, you'll release your mom also. Maybe the same ritual for you as our last caller.
Release her?
Yeah, yes. And that when you release it, you know, eventually you'll find yourself living for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for calling in.
Thanks so much.
Sure. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. So tomorrow I want to talk to all of you who are living the single life. I'm going to do a little research on that, and I will be discussing it with you as well. Sherry Siegel, thank you very much for being with me and helping me with the research today.
Thanks, Armand. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and we will be back with you tomorrow at noon, my friends. If you want to send me some advance email, it's Armand, ARMAND, at The Positive Mind. com.
Greetings, WBAI faithful. I'm Michael G. Haskins, chief announcer at WBAI. The station has been on an upswing in recent months. We've had two straight months of uninterrupted programming, a positive development for listeners. But time and the budget call for us to go to the airwaves and ask for your financial support of this gem that we call WBAI once again. This is how we keep the corporate dogs at bay and keep this radio station thriving. Join in supporting us with funds and as volunteers during our August mini drive from Monday, August 3rd through Saturday, August 15th. To volunteer, contact Vera at 212-209-2826 or at wbaivolunteers@gmail.com. It's crucial that we have volunteers during the 6 a.m. hour, as wake-up call will be pitching at that time. Find your volunteer shift at WBAI.org. We look forward to working closely with you again.
World 21st Century invites you to a thought-provoking forum on the topic, What Does It Mean to Be Black in America? A critical examination of the CNN sequel with special guest George Curry, former editor of Emerge magazine, and Fox News commentator Dr. Mark Amont Hill. Other speakers include Reverend Dennis Dillon, Councilman Charles Barron, Assemblywoman Inez Barron, and Gazembe Bass. Thursday.